Good morning.
Good morning.
And thank you, Bill, for inviting me to come. My name is Laura Burgess, and I practice at the San Francisco Zen Center. And I really enjoy thinking about a talk and watching what comes up for me as I consider coming and sharing a little bit of what has been so freely given to me over the years by my teachers. And recently I went to see a performance of The Wizard of Oz by one of my former students. And you'll see why that's helped me prepare for this talk. But storytelling is central to so many traditions. We have the parables of Jesus and the stories of the rabbis in the Jewish tradition. A lot of those stories full of humor and sort of poking fun at human beings and our foibles. The stories of the Sufi mystics. And when I came to Zen Center when I was fairly young, and I heard a lot of these Zen stories, the stories of the Blue Kuf records and the wonderful koans that are offered to us. Perhaps the most emblematic or famous koan in the Zen tradition is, "What is the sound of one hand clapping?" Or, "What is the sound of one hand clapping?" Yes. Well, I used to work in the Zen Center office, and for a couple of years there was this very grim mail carrier who would come every day and he'd bang on the door, and I'd go and answer it, and I never could get a smile out of this guy. And this would happen every day, and finally after a couple of years he banged on the door and I went and answered it, and he said, "That is the sound of one hand knocking." And I realized that he'd been working on a koan all those years. So one of these stories for me, these Zen stories that I heard when I was new to practice and that has been very important to me is the story, "Is That So?" A story about the Zen master and poet Hakuin Zenji. And a really wonderful thing for me in practice is how you hear these stories and these phrases from Dogen and these, we chant these sutras over and over again. And then in your life, as you're actually living your life, these phrases or stories can pop up in your everyday life, and they're there to guide us and help us. And it's a wonderful, for me, it's been a wonderful happenstance when I've been in the midst of my busy American life and one of these Zen stories has popped up and tapped me on the shoulder. So I'd like to just read the story to you. This is from this wonderful book, Zen Flesh, Zen Bones, which is copyright 1957. And in this book, Paul Reps took a number of the stories and teachings from the Buddhist tradition and compiled in this wonderful little book. So this is the story, "Is That So?" The Zen master Hakuin was praised by his neighbors as one living a pure life. A beautiful Japanese girl whose parents owned a food store lived near him. Suddenly, without any warning, her parents discovered she was with child. This made her parents angry. She would not confess who the man was, but after much harassment, at last named Hakuin. In great anger, the parents went to the master. "Is that so?" is all he would say. After the child was born, it was brought to Hakuin. By this time, he had lost his reputation, which did not trouble him. But he took very good care of the child. He obtained milk from his neighbors and everything else the little one needed. A year later, the girl mother could stand it no longer. She told her parents the truth, that the real father of the child was a young man who worked in the fish market. The mother and father of the girl at once went to Hakuin to ask his forgiveness, to apologize at length, and to get the child back again. Hakuin was willing in yielding the child. All he said was, "Is that so?" I'm sure a number of you are familiar with that story. And the reason it's important for me is because it encourages us to question. The central part of that story is this question, "Is that so?" And in the story, it's questioning the opinions other people have of us. is that so? But beyond that, to question our teachers, the teachings themselves, and to encourage us not to cling to any particular opinion or point of view of perception, our own ideas about ourselves and other people. And further, not clinging even to a beautiful teaching. To not stick to the ups and downs of other people's perceptions of us, the ups and downs of how the world seems to treat us. You know, we sit in an upright fashion, leaning neither to the right nor the left. And we can also go through the world like this, not buffeted about by opinion, by the ups and downs of every day, but staying true to our course in an upright way. Neither clinging nor pushing away. Suzuki Roshi, he said a lot of things were the most important thing. But one thing he said was, the most important two words in Zen are not always so. You notice there's really three words there. So I'd like to tell you how I've practiced with this story. Is that so? And I'd like to say first, you know, there's great suffering in the world today, especially in Haiti, where every day we see the terrible human suffering there. And there were already many orphans in Haiti, and now there are even more orphans. I know that when terrible things happen, people who believe in God, often their faith in God is challenged, especially when something terrible happens to them. There might be this idea, well, I thought I believed in God, why didn't he protect me? And in Buddhism, we don't have that kind of thought. We know that in life, terrible things happen. Good things happen. Bad things happen to good people. Good things happen to bad people. the thing is not that these terrible things happen. That's a reality as we live in our human body. But for us, the critical question is, how do we respond when something terrible happens? And I have a lot of faith that a lot of these children that are now orphans will be raising with love these children as if they were their own. Is that so? Something terrible has happened. What can we do? How can we respond? But I'd like to talk a little bit about this story in my own life. When I went to Tassajara in 1975 as a guest student, I was very taken by the way of life there, and I thought, if only I could come down here and practice, I could get away from all these troubling things that are bugging me all the time, and I could just sit and really, you know, really get into Zen practice. And so within very short order, I was living at Tassajara. I lived there for almost 3 years. But what I found when I sat down on my cushion at Tassajara facing the wall, and I know some of you have also practiced at Tassajara, all my ancient twisted karma had accompanied me there. You know, all my resentments, all my petty thoughts. I spent one sesshin with the theme song to the Flintstones going through my mind. It was all there. All my predilections, my opinions, my resentments, the people I'd harmed, the people I'd loved, all sat down with me on that cushion. And one of the things that I'd really loved was being in theater. I'd been in theater, community theater, and I majored in drama in college. And, I thought I'd left that all behind me when I came to Tassajara, and then I found out that there's a tradition in Buddhist monasteries to have a mid-practice period celebration, and part of that celebration is skit night. And so when I heard this was coming up, I spent many periods of zazen planning a skit for mid-practice period celebration. And one of the traditions of mid-practice period is to make fun of the roshi. This is part of the tradition in the monasteries. And this was during the time of Richard Baker Roshi. So I wrote this kind of musical comedy, and I called it instead of the Wizard of Oz, the Wizard of Zaz. And it was a takeoff on Richard Baker. And it's the story of a young girl growing up in Salina, Kansas, named Dorothy, who leaves Kansas to come west seeking enlightenment and ends up in a Buddhist monastery. And I had a lot of fun sitting there in Zazen writing this story and casting it in my mind and, you know, planning the costumes. Michael Ray is here today. He played the Tin Woodman wearing a hard hat. Peter Vandersteer was the Cowardly Lion. Tim Marshall played the Scarecrow. And Mark Lesser played the wizard's attendant. And the wizard never appears in the play because he's always on the phone, which was true of Richard Baker. Every time we'd knock on the door, the assistant would say, he's on the phone. And so I got to sing. I mean, it turns out, you know, if you write a play, you get to star in it. So I was Dorothy, of course. And, you know, people just loved it. This was in the dining room at Tassajara. People laughed, they clapped. I just was flooded with goodwill. It was a very heady brew. You know, one of our precepts is not to intoxicate the mind or body of self or others. And this was very intoxicating, especially in a monastery where everything is sort of concentrated and larger than life, in a sense. So it was my job at the end of this evening to go out and ring the big gong as people went to bed. And so I was out there with my hair in braids, wearing my red clogs and a little apron. I was still dressed as Dorothy. And I was ringing this gong, and I was crying. I was just crying because I'd had this realization that when we base our self-worth on the good opinion of others, that's a very slippery slope. And I realized that as much goodwill as this generated and as much praise and fame as I felt came to me momentarily in this play, that it was coming out of a very empty place in myself, a place that longed for recognition, that longed for applause. And I realized that in my whole life, being in plays and hearing the applause and the laughter from the audience was a kind of substitute for something deeper in life that I was longing for, that couldn't be satisfied by that momentary praise of an audience. And the next day, I didn't get up for Zazen. I stayed in my cabin and tried to come to terms with this. And I decided that I just wouldn't do that kind of thing anymore. That it came from a very needy place in myself, and that I didn't need to do that anymore. And it was a long time before I allowed myself to do something like that. It took some years of practice before I was willing to say, you know, this is something I can do. This is something I can offer, this kind of... And now I'm in a puppet show about the Vimalakirti Sutra where I get to indulge that part of that ham in myself. But it's coming from another place. It's coming from a place of offering rather than... I just think of Sally Fields in her Oscar speech saying, "You like me, you really like me." You know, I don't need to do that anymore. So that's an example for me of how this story, Is That So?, has worked in my life. That when people clap for us and praise us and say how wonderful we are, we can say, "Is that so?" Because actually we know the whole truth of ourselves, that we're not purely wonderful, we're not purely terrible, we're somewhere in the middle. So this brings me to the 8 worldly dharmas, another teaching that's related to the story. And this is one way that we create suffering for ourselves in allowing ourselves to be buffeted about by these 8 worldly dharmas. And these are kind of dualistic pairs that we find ourselves crashing back and forth between in our lives. And they are praise and blame, fame and disgrace, gain and loss, pleasure and pain. So, you know, these things aren't going to go away. They're part of our human life. But if we raise them up into our consciousness, then we can notice when we're being knocked off center, when we're being intoxicated by the praise of other people, by the applause and the laughter, or when we're being pulled down by people's low opinion of us if we make a mistake. So falling into these opposites causes suffering to ourselves. And it's very easy to think, oh, if I could only stay on that side of praise and fame and gain and pleasure, everything would be okay. But the thing is, we can't stay over there. And I think sometimes we feel like if we're not on that side of the equation, there's something wrong with us, that we failed in some way. When actually, these dualisms are just part of our everyday life. So pleasure, praise, and fame, and gain, these things can cause a kind of euphoria. You know, we talk about being on a pink cloud. It doesn't get any better than this. You know, yes, everything's going my way. Some of these expressions, you know, head over heels, nothing can touch us. So when this transient state, this euphoric pink cloud is ripped away from us, then we're plunged into the other side of that equation, you know, pain and blame and disgrace and loss. And then some other phrases come to mind, you know, down in the dumps, in the feeling blue. I used to have a little I teach third grade, and I had a little girl in my class who, and I shake my kids' hands at the beginning of the day, and I'd shake their hand, I'd say, how are you, how are you? And this little third grader looked up at me and said, my life is a barren wasteland. And I'm sure she just heard that somewhere. But wow, I thought, even third graders have their bad days. But certainly we feel that way sometimes. We can be in that side of the equation where we feel, you know, nothing ever goes right, I can't do anything right, nobody loves me, everybody hates me, I'm going to eat some worms. That's that other side of that equation. But, you know, both of these ways of thinking are actually very self-centered and delusional, self-involved ways to experience the world. So to intoxicate the mind or body of self or others, we can be intoxicated by these pleasurable states of when the scale seems to be up. We can also be intoxicated by self-pity and remorse and regret. We can wallow in that. That's another kind of intoxication. So on that side of the equation, I'd like to tell a story about, is that from this point of view of, is that so? Something that happened to me as a teacher. And when this happened to me, I'll tell you kind of not in too much detail, but this story. I went to my teacher, Linda Ruth Cutts, and told her this story. She said a wonderful thing to me. She said, if you ever wonder what ego is, watch what happens when you're falsely accused. So what happened to me was I've been teaching for 24 years. At this point, I'd been teaching about 12 years. So I taught a number of children. I had a good reputation at my school. Many of the people in my class, the children in my class at that time, their parents were on the board of directors of my school or had other siblings in my class. So I was well known at this school. But I had sympathy when I went through this period of my teaching of what it must be like to be a new teacher and be falsely accused when you don't have a reputation or a fund of goodwill behind you. So what happened to me was there was a little girl in my class who was new to the school, and before she even came into my class, her mother conceived a resentment against me. And even before she knew me, she conceived a resentment against me. It later turned out she was not a well woman and that this resentment was based on nothing. But it colored everything that happened between us and with her daughter. And it resulted in this mother writing a 12-page letter to the board of directors of my school, cataloging all the ways in which I'd harmed her daughter. There were dates and times, these terrible, humiliating, abusive things I'd done to her child. And I received a copy of this, and I was horrified to read this. And all I can think is either she made these things up, or she would ask her daughter when she got home from school every day, "What did Laura do to you today?" That, you know, children know what their parents want to hear, and this child made up these stories. I don't know. But I felt, as I read this letter, I thought, well, a lot of people who are reading this letter, the members of the board of directors, are going to realize that I would not make a child stand in the rain when she was sick because she'd done something wrong in class, which was one of the things in this letter. And so here again, I found this story, Is That So?, coming into my heart and mind. And I actually wrote a letter to the board of directors telling them this story of Hawkwind's and saying that as a teacher, you would hope that I would foster and encourage your child and love them and educate them and hold them in my heart, but at the very least, that I would do no harm. And all I have as a teacher is my reputation. And so all I can say is that so? Now, I had a lawyer working with me at the time. He thought that was rather an obscure story, but I found it very comforting at the time. So that story was very, very helpful for me, because I noticed when I was going through this that I would have long conversations with this mother in my mind, arguments with her. I would stick up for myself. I would, you know, she took up residence in my mind. And because of my practice, I realized we don't have to do that. When something terrible happens to us, we don't have to replay it in our mind. We can let this phrase, "Is that so?", come to mind. And by the way, there may be times when we have been at fault. We might ask ourselves, "Is that so?" And we might say, "Yes, I've done some harm here. I need to make amends." You know, if you're being evaluated by your boss and he's criticizing you or she's criticizing you, probably not the right time to say, "Is that so?" You might say, "Well, I need to work with this. I need to think about this." So, of course, we should always be open to feedback, to evidence, to the comments and the feedback of the people we love and even the people we don't love. So it might be easy to say, "Is that so?" You know, when we're blamed for something, especially something we didn't do. But what about when we're praised? What about when people are telling us how wonderful we are? Can we also let that roll off our back, you know, like water off a duck's back? We don't just suffer because of the things that happen to us. You know, wanting to avoid suffering is itself suffering. Wanting things to be other than the way they are. Wanting to be someone other than who we are. Wishing something, it wasn't happening to us. Wishing that someone was different than the way they are. All of these are a kind of suffering. And so the eight worldly dharmas aren't going to go away. They're called dharmas because they are things as they are. They're called dharmas because they are teachings. They're the stuff of our practice. They're a way that we can, as Dogen said, study the self. We can work with them by asking questions like, how do I react to what happens? Am I attached to certain kinds of experiences? Am I leaning into that praise and that gain and that fame and that pleasure? Am I attached to those things? And then do I reject or avoid other kinds of experiences? How am I intoxicated by these eight worldly dharmas, whether the so-called positive or the so-called negative? Do I intoxicate others with my praise and my blame? So I can forget that I made this stuff up. something that might just devastate me for hours, these long conversations with this person who falsely accused me, something that might devastate me might have absolutely no effect on the person sitting next to me. It's my attitude, it's what I do with my experience, how I respond to it, that makes the difference. So I'd like to share a wonderful quote by the Tibetan teacher Pema Chodron. She says, "We make ourselves up as we go along. We have a concept of ourselves that we construct moment by moment and reflexively try to protect. But this concept that we are protecting is questionable, like pushing and pulling a vanishing illusion." So this illusion, I think, is especially true if I base my sense of myself on what I think other people think of me, which is really none of my business and something I have absolutely no control over. Jack Kornfeld said, "If you are content much of the time, if you can regard others' good fortune and your own bad fortune with equanimity, if you wish everyone well and dwell without regret in the present moment, you are probably a dog." So I think we might aspire to those things, but it's only a good-natured Cocker Spaniel that can really live that way moment by moment. So it's certainly a mistake to think we're going to kick out these eight worldly dharmas. They're kind of like a shadow puppet show that teaches us where we get stuck, where we get caught, where we get hooked, pushed and pulled by things that really aren't all that solid, things that are very ephemeral. And in meditation, when we sit silently as we just did together, we sit, we follow our breath, we count our breath, and then the puppet show is there in the background. And we can notice that. We can notice what comes up for us in meditation. See how our emotions are stirred up by thoughts of loss, by the elation of praise, by feelings of pleasure or pain, literal pain when we sit sesshin. When we've suffered some unjust treatment or been insulted, suffered some disgrace or embarrassment, these are all part of our human life, and they sit with us on the cushion. So, recently I hurt my neck. I don't know what happened, but I noticed that when I'm in physical pain, I feel like I failed in some way. You know, I must have done something wrong. This is a very common thing to think when we're ill, when we're not feeling well. But actually, just as Shakespeare said, these are the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, just part of being in a human body. So if we have a human body, we will sometimes get injured. Sometimes we'll feel well. We don't have that much control over it. Practice is not an inoculation against illness or sickness or death. I know when I first started practicing and I heard that Buddha taught about sickness, old age, and death, I certainly didn't think he was talking about me. And now after a number of years, I realized, yeah, these are things we all contend with. So whether praised or blamed, whether we're sick or well, whether we're losing or gaining, we can stop, take a breath, and turn back to our breath, return to this present moment and breathe deeply, sitting upright, neither leaning to the right nor the left. So in everyday life, how I can practice with this is to watch what happens when I'm insulted or criticized. Do I make up a grievance story about it and then tell everybody who will listen this story about how I've been wronged? Instead of noticing that this is a wispy illusion I've created. And by the way, if I'm insulted, so what? You know, that's ego. That's practicing with ego. And if I know that the feeling of inflation when I'm praised is going to go away, it's going to quickly evaporate, just as that feeling of debasement when I'm blamed for something will also evaporate, I just don't have to take it all that seriously. There can be some joy and humor in that, some poking fun at myself. So I think this is part of what we talk about in practice about non-attachment. which is not a cold, heartless, walled-off thing. It's more intimate than that. It's warmer than that. It's more humorous than that. You know, it's not saying, I will not feel anything. It's juggling those feelings like the balls of a circus clown. You know, they go up, they go down. It's a way to be lighter and more humorous about the human comedy. And if I can lighten up on myself, then I can be lighter on others. I can be kinder to others. I can be forgiving towards others, knowing I've done these things myself. So those are some things that came to my mind as I think about, is that so? A wonderful teaching about and by Hakuin Zenji, the Zen poet, who also said a wonderful thing that I often remember. And by the way, I know that Hakuin was kind of a wild man, and things didn't always go so well for him. But he nevertheless said, having had the good fortune not only to have been born into this world as a human being, but also to have encountered the teaching of the great Shakyamuni Buddha, how can we help but be overjoyed? So thank you very much, and I'd like to open this up to questions or discussion. There may be a particular Buddhist phrase or teaching that has been some illumination or comfort to you, but thank you very much, and I'll see if there's anything you'd like to say or ask about. Mio, yes.
I have a feeling that there are also times when you say, that's not so.
Uh-huh.
Would you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. What does that mean for you, Mio?
Well, if something is actually inaccurate or distorted,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or there's some kind of wrong view that is actually causing harm,
mm-hmm.
It's sometimes necessary to stand up and say, wait, it's not like that.
Yeah.
So that's just an aspect that occurs to me.
Yes. I think maybe what comes up in considering that is there can be a kind of passivity, shrugging things off, and not taking action when it's necessary. And I think sometimes Buddhism is thought of as too passive or detached in a way that, well, I don't have to worry about that, that's just the world. And so I think often the world calls on us to stand up, to say, to take a stand against injustice, to say that isn't so. And there's so much in the media now that isn't so. It's kind of incredible what can happen with the press of a button on our computers, the kind of distortions and half-truths and untruths that are promulgated, that swirl around us. And so I think maybe now more than ever, it's important for each of us as an individual, whatever our belief, but particularly if we feel that we're Buddhist, to take a stand and say, this isn't right. And I could cite a number of things that are in the news right now. So that phrase, is that so, shouldn't encourage us to just sit on our cushion and not do anything. Because one thing that happens to a lot of people in practice is it looks like we're not doing very much sitting here. But what can happen as we sit is a deep intention can come up in us of how we want to address the ills of the world. And some people might do prison outreach. Some people might make sandwiches for the homeless. In my case, what arose for me was that I could, Suzuki Roshi talked about shine one corner of the world. Pick, you know, Mother Teresa said, pick one small thing and do it with your whole heart. And for me, that was teaching kids. So I think that's a very important point, that when we hear something that's not true, to say, that isn't so. Does that touch on what
yes,
you're thinking
you.
Of, Mio? Thank you, yeah.
I guess ideally, when I find myself about to say that, if I can do so with some grace, that's best, but it doesn't always come out that way.
Yeah, that's true. And also to question our own thoughts. I'm always really happy when I have certain narrow-minded thoughts about a person and they blow me out of the water by doing something that's totally contrary to my petty little limited point of view of them. So I think especially when we're, not just when we're judging ourselves, but when we're judging others, we can also say, is that so? Might not be the whole picture. Yes.
I, in listening to the story and then hearing this gentleman's question, also went back to the story in which, in saying, is that so, then this man took on the responsibility for a year of raising a newborn child, mm-hmm. which is very much an activist, you know, move to raise a child. And that gave the community a chance, again, to see in action
mm-hmm.
How a life, one life is affected adversely or well by another.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just brought in my heart to think of that,
mm-hmm.
the year in the life of raising a child, and what an active and amazing in the face of an untruth
mm-hmm.
Action that is.
And what an ordinary thing to raise a child. People do it all the time, but what a miraculous thing.
Yeah.
And what a grave responsibility it is to raise a child.
I consider it an extraordinary thing.
It really is. Yeah. And also, this image of Hawkwind Zenji just quietly, without a lot of fanfare, doing the next right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And without expecting any accolades, just doing the most obvious thing, which is taking care of a child. You know, and in our own lives, we can say, what is that newborn child that's in my life right now? What is the next right thing? What is the most important thing? And sometimes it's something very obvious that we might be overlooking. We might think, there's some great task for me in this world, and overlook the fact that there's another person sitting in front of me right now that needs a kind word or a helping hand. So we can also look at that newborn baby as a part of ourselves that needs nourishing and needs attention that we sometimes ignore. And sometimes that baby cries to get our attention. Thank you. So do any of you have a Zen phrase or story that's helped you or come up for you in your everyday life? It doesn't have to be Zen either.
Talking about a breakfast, kind of a poem by Shredo, where he says the old lapis lazuli mansion illuminates the moon. A fierce dog tiptoes upstairs for nothing. And Shredo showed me the dogs actually do tiptoe when they want to. So I find that fierce dog tiptoeing up the stairs all the time, sort of sneaking up the stairs.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so when you were thinking, or you were talking about how you and your accused, you react in a certain way, and that dog is right there at the top of the stairs. And I find that, but it applies in daily life, but it also applies, I think, to the way thoughts arise in general. You know, there's a thought, there's something that you think you need to react to, the thought is just right there, and you know, and for what?
Yeah.
It comes so. So I was wondering, as you were saying, you know, talking about your experience, I had a sense of in our lives, it's very important to watch. It's important to see our reactions to other people. It's important to respond in an appropriate way. And I got a sense that there's sort of a lifelong effort at self-improvement. And I was wondering, well, how does that relate to the actual practice of sitting?
You know, by the way, I can hear those dog toenails on the stairs. self-improvement, that term for me reminds me a little bit of the Zen phrase, putting a hat on top of a hat. You know, for me, our practice is not so much as polishing that tile or making a new and improved version of ourselves, but getting down to who we actually are, who we're actually meant to be, you might say our original face. And one thing I think about, you're saying, asking about how practice can affect that, I think by just sitting quietly every day for some period of time, we don't do it for any gaining idea. We don't do it to improve or get anything. But I think as a result of that, when something happens, rather than just responding in an knee-jerk way, instinctively, from some reactive part of ourself, we have this wonderful, tiny moment where we have a choice of how we respond. So when Myo mentions, you know, when something happens and thinking, that's not so, you know, sometimes we could, if we respond instinctually, there's anger, there's resentment, there's self-righteous indignation there. And I think it's often helpful to stop a moment, take a breath, and come from a deeper place in ourselves. And then other people can hear us better because we're speaking out of compassion for them, where we're also speaking out of the recognition that I too have these qualities. I'm not better than. I also respond poorly sometimes. I'm not sure this is making sense, but we've all had that flash of anger, that flash of resentment. But if we can be in alignment with another person, especially someone we're in conflict with, and we meet them heart to heart from a place of compassion, then we're not responding so instinctually. And then we can still say our truth, but from a place of meeting instead of a place of conflict and difference. So I would say that rather than striving for self-improvement, we settle down into who we're actually meant to be. And it's a more comfortable place. It's a familiar place. It starts to feel like home, a place we come to in our sitting. So that's a kind of freedom we have, to not respond instinctually, but to take a breath and come from a deeper, more compassionate place in ourselves. And you had another comment.
Well, I did, and I am listening to this one. Another story came to mind, a story I heard on the radio. A woman had one of her dear friends was the head of the World Aid and Rescue Organization. He actually was the person who said, okay, these tents will go here and we will help in this way and these people. And he was in an African country that was in great turmoil. And the day before, some of the workers for the organization had been kidnapped and their lives had ended. And then that day, as he was walking with his companions back to their sanctuary, they too were taken. And they were in the back of a truck, and there were two armed young men. It was not a good situation. And he turned to his companions and he said, "We must rewrite this story. We are not in danger. These men are helping us." And they began to thank the men. They said, thank you very much. We know it's very dangerous here now, and we're grateful for the protection that you offer us. And the men with the guns were confused by this, needless to say. But they, they continued to be there. The people were taken to a holding space where they were locked up. And as the one man with the gun was leaving, he turned to them and he said, "It's okay, you'll be safe here." And it feels metaphysical when I tell it. It's the energy from within of not being in fear and rewriting the story as it was told to those of us who were listening. And that this man and these people were able to confront this great, grave situation and look into, in a sense, the hearts of these two young men with guns. And 2 days later, they were released. And so this energetic adjustment, if you will, I might call it magic, is very real.
That's a marvelous story.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Yeah.
And my first comment was just to paraphrase Mary Oliver, who is, I think, an extraordinary poet who lives amongst us. And I can't quite remember, but she asked the question, "What will you do with this one most extraordinary life?"
Mm-hmm.
And that always helps me because it brings me into the moment again.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. In the midst of these horrible stories coming from Haiti, of course, there are always amazing stories of resilience and compassion, the response around the world of people. My school kids all brought in their dimes and pennies, and there was a story about a little boy who survived in the rubble for 8 days.
Mm-hmm.
His parents had already died, but his uncle is there for him. What an incredible story of survival.
Mm-hmm.
And of people rushing in to help. So there's always that in the midst of terrible suffering.
And the phrase she used is, we can rewrite this story.
Yeah.
We can change this in this way. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Any last thoughts before we have some tea? Well, thank you all for coming out on this day and sharing the Dharma. Thank you very much.